Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygate. It's 3:06 on Friday afternoon. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. It is cold here in Atlanta, and I hope you're staying warm around the state. I hope you have a little warmer temperatures than we do here down in Macon, Savannah, or wherever you're listening to the show. A lot to talk about. Jim Galloway, the political writer for the AJC, is with us. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays. Well, what are you writing for Sunday?
Oh, we've got an Electoral College vote coming up on Thursday.
Yeah.
We almost had a system that would have put Hillary Clinton in the White House from Georgia. Georgia electoral votes would have gone that way.
All right, so maybe we'll get a little preview of that.
Okay, all right, Steve and I can talk about that.
State Senator Steve Henson, the Democratic leader in the state Senate, is with us. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Thank you, Bill.
Jackie Gingrich Cushman, one of the real Republican insiders, joins us wearing a very festive holiday necklace,
Thank you. That is actually from Coca-Cola. It's one of their works called the 5x20 program. So Coke, I know I've got to use this as a commercial, right? So the goal of the 5x20 is to have 5 million women across the world empowered through entrepreneurship by 2020. So you can go to Coca-Cola and look at the 5x20 products.
All right. That sounded like an underwriting message. We need to call Coca-Cola. And I am really happy to be able to welcome for the first time the veteran political reporter for WSB-TV in Atlanta, Lori Geary. What a pleasure to have
Thank
you here.
Thank you. It is so great to finally be able to come on with you, Bill. I had some big shoes to fill when you left WSB-TV, let me tell you.
I was thinking about this the other day. Between you and I think we represent a good, I did 20 years and you did an additional
13.
So we represent 33 years of political reporting. But you've now decided to go off on your own. Go ahead, as long as we hear about Coca-Cola.
Well, I need to do this 5x20. I'm an entrepreneur and I'm a woman.
Absolutely.
I just decided, my kids are 5 and 9. And as you know, Bill, and you folks in here know, TV hours are just very long and crazy and unstable. So it was just time for me to take a step back and really enjoy these precious moments and these precious ages with my kids and my husband. And so I just started my own communications firm and doing corporations and corporate videos and media strategy and media consulting. So far, so good.
I mean, some would say you've gone over to the dark side, Lori.
I know.
I think she's gone over to the money side.
Just the normal flexible hours side.
Yeah, there you go.
And hopefully some money side.
Let me update you on a couple of stories that have just broken in the last couple of hours. Number one, the White House has announced that President Obama has ordered a report on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Obviously, he wants that report delivered before he leaves office on January 20th. There's no word on whether the plan is to release it to the public or not. You know, Jim, you've got to think, considering that just this week in his interview with Time magazine for the Man of the Year cover, Donald Trump once again said, no, there's no interference. You've got to think that the president is making sure this issue doesn't go away. And of course, the Congress is going to do the same thing.
No, I disagree. I don't think that they can. I don't think they'll come out with a report before January 20th. But I think the object here is if Donald Trump wants this issue to go away, he's going to have to work positively. He's going to have to make a positive action to make it go away.
Okay, well, we should say, of course, that John McCain, Lindsey Graham, other Republicans
Lindsey Graham has promised
have
to
said
to
they're
investigate.
Going to investigate right. this, too. The other news that we got today from the transition team is that Donald Trump has named Gary Cohn as the head of the National Economic Council. What's interesting about that, Jackie, is this is another Goldman Sachs guy. He is already got a couple of other Goldman Sachs partners in there. And this is just the irony of what happens after an election. Having campaigned against Hillary Clinton's ties to Goldman Sachs and other big banking firms, he's loaded with Goldman Sachs folks.
Well, I think he's done a couple of things that are really smart. First of all, I think he's listened to the people that elected him and has heard that they actually want to have change and they want to have something different. And my point is that they recognize that he's not part of the political process, as these gentlemen are not. And they also want people that have been very successful. I mean, one of the things that are very attractive about Donald Trump is he's very successful in business. I mean, every time he got up in front of anywhere. We heard about that, right? He's been very successful in whatever he's done. He talks about that. And so I think what he's doing is, if you look at his cabinet, is he's replicating that same kind of success with who he's putting in his cabinet positions.
Steve?
Well, you know, that's debatable. He had many successes in everything he's done, and some of the people that he's appointing now have some very unusual beliefs that I think that when fully exposed to the public, are there going to be some concerns.
Well, we do want to talk later in the show about the appointments that he's made in the past week or so, and there is going to be some controversy and some interesting discussions when they come up for their confirmation hearings early next year. So let's do that.
I want to just say one thing is that Donald Trump, you know, ran on this campaign that he wanted to drain the swamp. Well, he is, in a way, because he's not appointing all of these politicos and people who have all this experience in government. I mean, transportation secretary, yes, we have Tom Price. There are some picks, but let's see how these outsiders do. Let's see how these business folks do. You know, I mean, you can go down the list. I mean, this is kind of testing the waters here.
He's not picking alligators. He's choosing crocodiles instead.
And a lot of these have been involved in the public arena for a long time in different ways. And you can see in the Obama administration and others, we had a lot of people who weren't elected officials coming into different roles. So
let's hold our conversation about some of the Trump picks for later in the show, because Steve Henson, I want to give you a first shot at this. Last week, Speaker of the House, Republican Speaker of the House, David Ralston, sat down to talk with Jim and me about his plans for the upcoming session. And so we think it's crucial that we give you a chance to talk about what Democrats have in mind. Clearly, you are outgunned in every way down at the state capitol. It's hard to have an offensive agenda. So what are you going to be fighting against?
Well, we're hopefully going to find some Republican friends on some of these issues. You know, like, when you look at voting fairness, a lot of Republicans for some time have been talking about whether or not the voting system is fair, and have wanted paper ballots, wanted a paper trail. And so therefore, one of the things what we want to do, we have an antiquated voting system in Georgia that should really be replaced. And the Secretary of State has said that he wants to go through another election, maybe look at 2020. But Democrats are going to be acting trying to get money in the budget so that we can start replacing our antiquated voting system now. Try to go to OptiScan, where there'll be a paper trail. Florida and other states have it. I think it'll add some confidence level to the folks out there. I think we can also back a bill, I think Jim might talk about later, making sure the popular vote, you know.
Well, go ahead. Let's talk about that.
Well, last session I co-sponsored Senate Bill 376. David Schaefer was the first sponsor, the president of the Senate, and it would have made us enter into a compact with other states that if the electoral vote, if enough states entered into it to carry the election, when the electoral vote went one way, our state would be committed to that vote. And, you know, hopefully I'll have my Republican colleagues stick with
me. I don't think so. No. You've already got David Schaefer telling me that he has changed his mind and no longer supports that bill. And Earl Earhart had a similar piece of legislation in the House last session, and he says he's going to give it a rest. But now he hasn't given up on it. He might be a future partner for you.
Well, you know, I think we had 50 signatures last time. So
it's all in the timing.
I was going to say, gee, what's changed that would make these Republicans suddenly oppose?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think the important thing is, I think once you, I mean, if you have a whatever your framework is in place at the time of an election, that's what you go with. And if you want to change, you've got to look forward and not look back, because, I mean, look, we've all been involved with politics for a very long time. And one of the first things you do is you look around and say, okay, how is this done? Is this done by popular vote? Is this some electoral college? What are actually the rules of the game?
Yeah.
And depending on what they are at the time in which you run, then you follow those exact rules. And if you look at what Trump did, he absolutely, I mean, Kellyanne Conway has talked about this time and time again. He absolutely knew where he was in the different states, and he absolutely knew where he needed to be to get to 270. And everyone talked about 270. And that's what he got. So,
and I also think that this last election showed that the Republicans have a very distinct edge when it comes to small states between the two coasts. And that's another reason why I don't think I don't think your legislation is going to move.
Well, you know, you talk about the rules and when they were in place. I remember that a lot of the guys in the state Senate who were in the minority pushing for fair reapportionment and a fair reapportionment commission. Now that I'm not listening and not hearing that anymore, that's one thing we're going to be pushing for this year is to move to a reapportionment commission that will be independent of the partisan politics.
Well, absolutely. And having my father's district actually cut up into little pieces when the Georgia was controlled by the Democrats, and he had to move out of where his home was because they cut his district into little pieces.
They only moved him from the south side of Atlanta to the far north side.
So let me just say, the reality is, I mean,
well,
this is
how.
Well, in
92, I was a Democrat. I only had seven out of 42 precincts left.
In our 33 years of combined political reporting, we have heard this argument from both sides.
Yeah, yeah, it's certainly true, Steve.
Yeah, I'm certainly.
That Bobby Kahn would be a prime example of what happens when the Democrats control the state house. He did a pretty good job gerrymandering the state, as he did with Newt Gingrich.
He totally cut him out of his district, right.
And that is why the public has to speak on this. So, I think the general public does not want these strongly partisan or strongly gerrymandered
I don't think
seats.
The general public understands it.
A lot of people, I think, do. If you poll, do you want the legislature to draw the districts based solely on partisan nature of the district, I think they'll say no.
But okay, but let's get back to the main point, which is where do Democrats in the legislature have clout this coming session?
Right.
Where can they provide the votes that a Republican will need to pass this issue or that issue?
Well, you know, it will depend on where they're moving forward. You know, there's certainly big education issues up there. You know, how the governor moves forward on his reform commission recommendations on education and funding. You know, that'd be something they may want some help on. The bed tax on hospitals.
Oh, that's a big one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you know, several years ago, Democrats refused to go with the plan that was being proposed. The lieutenant governor twisted arms, got it passed in the Senate, and ended up getting some of his powers taken away the following year.
Let's be sure that our listeners understand the bed tax. We have talked about it before, but it's essentially a tax that hospitals will have to pay.
It really has no connection to a specific bed.
Right.
It's the so-called bed tax.
Right. But the point is, it's a new effort. Your colleagues down there are looking for ways, especially now that Obamacare is going by the wayside, to fund Medicaid, and a bed tax seems to be one possible approach that is going to come back this year, right?
That's correct.
Right. And what happens is you draw the money from the hospitals, you use that money to match federal dollars,
right?
I think, on a 2-to-1 basis or some such thing.
Well, you know, and it's hard to say whether they're going to come back with gun bill again or RFRA again. Both of those would either have to be something drastically changed to get Democratic support, but if they wanted to try to work with us, you know, both in the House and the Senate, we each gained a seat, Democratic side. So, you know, they barely passed that education OSD bill that was defeated by Georgia voters last year. They probably won't try that again. And many of the constitutional amendments they've made have been very tough to pass. It'll be a little tougher now, not impossible.
Jim, I think on the Political Insider blog, didn't I read that out in Athens, the speaker or someone said, yes, we're coming back with a new version of campus carry.
Yeah, the speaker is coming back with a new version. And he implied as much when he was here last week.
Right.
He's coming back with a new version of campus carry. I don't know what the appetite for in the Senate is, but it'll definitely get through the House, given that the Rules Committee chairman is its primary sponsor.
Well, when he said new version, any insight into that?
Well, he said they were studying whether to address some of the governor's objections.
Yeah. I think one of the primary objections, at least that I heard from people that I talked to, was the fact that you have so many child care centers on the campuses, and that there were no restrictions in terms of where that would be, where you could carry. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah, there was a huge concern.
Right. Last year, the governor, after the bill had passed, suddenly came up with a list of concerns he had, and one of them was.
But I will say, I investigated that, and most of those child care centers, if not all of them, were in dormitories, which were excluded from that gun law. So I think that was a matter of perception, also, of getting that word out, perhaps.
Okay. But, you know, an issue like that, first of all, there were many problems with that bill, so I don't know if it could get Democratic support. But you talked about our agenda. One thing we'd like to see is for people in Georgia that have carry permits to go through some type of training. Nothing burdensome, 4 hours or so. South Carolina has it. Tennessee has it. These are reasonable requests. And before we see people on college campuses permitted to carry weapons, I think it'd be reasonable to ask majority party, let's make Georgia go with the over 40 other states that have some requirement for training for carry.
Where would that bill, who's gonna sponsor that bill? Where will it start, House or Senate? Or
I'll be putting a version in the state Senate.
For just the training part of it?
For just the training, we have some other elements of the, of course, last year you had an assault weapons ban and a 50 caliber bullet by Mary Margaret Oliver in the House. You've seen a couple other bills as far as, being able to, I had a bill in that said if a police officer asks to see your carry permit, you should show it to them. So there'll be other little elements, but certainly the training for a carry permit will be a separate bill.
Jackie is looking puzzled.
No, I was listening to all the other elements because the training, all the other elements could be, this, that, and the other, but the training itself, I think, makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have, my husband does have a carry permit, and my son does not, but he does hunt, but they're both very, very safe. I mean, to your point, safety is their number one concern, so everything's locked up in the house when they go out. I mean, they're always unloaded. They have it, if it's a shotgun, they have it pulled apart. I mean, so I do agree. I totally agree with the fact that you should have some type of training and that safety should be a priority. You should know what you're doing before you, get a gun and carry it around.
Right. Actually, Bill, that's one thing that did come out in Athens at this the biennial gathering of state lawmakers earlier this week, and that was that the governor said that in addition to boosting the base pay for state troopers in Georgia, he was going to be including money for specific training, increased training for state troopers, including on how to de-escalate confrontations, which I would imagine that you folks would be very much in favor of that.
Yeah, he talked about moving that to the post training program so they get a lot more officers into de-escalation, negotiation, and those sort of things. And that's important.
You had another item you want to share with us?
Well, I want to mention that education is always going to be a hot topic. And we're going to have some progressive things to try to make sure that HOPE is more fully funded, trying to get some general fund monies and college education grants to those. We have a lot of people who aren't qualifying for HOPE and that are dropping out of our colleges and not able to go. And Georgia, is going the wrong direction as far as enrollment in state college education. So we need to do more there. K through 12, we're probably going to be responsive to the governor's plan, but whether we stick with a QBE funding formula or have a new formula, we need to make sure that formula is properly graduated or adjusted for inflation and other increases in cost. Neither QBE or the governor's plan under the recommendations were fully tied to increased costs.
Well, Lori, having covered the Capitol as you've done for a number of years now, first of all, waiting for the governor to come forth with a bill that would fix or change the quality-based education funding formula, it's like waiting for Godot. We're not sure that he's going to bring it again this session. And in the meantime, House Republican, one of your last big stories in covering the run-up to the election would have been the Opportunity School District Amendment. Mm-hmm. Having failed, now we hear House Republicans saying they've got a plan that they're ready to refine and bring forward, which will, in a sense, it creates more school choice, I think, more than anything else.
It'll be interesting to see what the governor comes up with on this issue, because he's not going to let it go. He's not going to let these failing schools continue under this local school control, whether we see more power going to the state school board, whether we see him exercising this takeover of the local school boards, we'll have to see. I don't think we've seen voucher legislation before. We've seen it introduced. It has gone nowhere. It's not even really passed a committee. I don't think we're there yet. I don't think that the Republicans will go that far.
Well, it's a shame, because one thing we introduced last year with OSD as a competitor was the community school program, like they did in Kentucky, where we actually put resources like tutoring help and financial resources in schools that are failing. Kentucky saw a tremendous change in their national performance on the education for K through 12. I think we can see the changes that we need if we would implement something that addresses the underlying problems. And I have heard some positive things. If he does have some change in formula, that he'll include a quotient or an element about poverty, that would be a great thing. But there are tools right now that he has to go into schools, even though local schools, and add additional resources.
Yeah, which was one of the complaints by the critics of OSD. Jim, the broader strokes that I've heard about what the House is looking at has to do with giving families an opportunity if they, over a certain period of time, feel the school is failing, if they're not satisfied, moving to another public school.
And that's not unlike the idea behind vouchers. Where that falls apart,
right,
though, is on the issue of transportation, of getting the kid every day to the right class, to the school. And that can be, if you're in a poor neighborhood, you're still dealing with the same bus system. That part does not change.
It's interesting, we're going to take a break, but it is interesting that the governor said, whether he will stick with this or not, the other day, if the House has a plan, I think they should move it forward. Maybe I'll find it worth listening to, suggesting maybe he doesn't have to have his own plan.
Well, he's got a little bit of a problem in that the House Republicans lost a couple seats.
Right.
And they're blaming it on OSD. So maybe he wants them to make the first move just to see how far they're willing to go.
All right, let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. It's 3:27 on Friday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. Back in a moment.
People in developing countries are using their phones to bank, and new research says it goes much deeper than that.
Is this like a new toy for people, or does it actually fundamentally change their lives? Does it solve poverty?
I'm Ari Shapiro. Beyond the convenience of mobile banking, changing lives for the poorest families. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon right here on GPB.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network of GPB. Good afternoon, I'm Ellen Reinhart. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
As you listen to us on Political Rewind, remember you can join the conversation, as some of you have, by tweeting us at PoliticsGPB, PoliticsGPB. We'll get to some of those tweets later on in the show. Today, Lori Geary, former political reporter from WSB-TV, Jackie Gingrich Cushman, a longtime member of our panel, back for the first time in a while. It's so good to see you, Jackie. State Senator Steve Henson and Jim Galloway all at the table. Steve, we want to give you one more chance.
You're talking about some of the issues. We're still pushing for Medicaid expansion. You know, the federal dollars are still there. Until things are changed, if they're going to be changed at the federal level, we are making a terrible mistake not bringing those dollars that Georgia taxpayers paid to come down and service those people who are needy with health issues and get them into the Medicaid rolls.
Jackie, I would think given that Tom Price, our friend Tom Price, is going to go into office and help unravel Obamacare, the chances that the Republicans are going along with what Steve Henson is suggesting are pretty nil, yeah?
I think you're right, and I think Governor Dill's been very consistent about what he said about this. He's interested in anything that's a long-term, sustainable fix to make this work. But to your point, you know, it's probably not going to be long-term. So my guess is they'll hold off and wait and see what happens. I would like to comment, just to go back a minute, from about education. And I think one of the reasons that Governor Dill is not going to let go of this, even though he may want the Republicans to take some leadership role in what happens next, is because he's been very involved. His wife, Sandra, was a teacher. He understands how important education is, and he's actually been a very big advocate of early education, even prior to school. But I think we have to remember that this isn't really just about school systems and dollars. This is really about children. And so in the end, when we think about what can we do, I think we need to really look into ourselves and say, how do we actually reach those children? And the way you do that is through the teachers. And it really is about making sure the teachers have the right education, the right training, and the right mindset to really want to reach those children, because it's hard work. My mom was a teacher. That was her career. She taught high school math. But I really think sometimes we get lost in the details of the structure and the system of education and forget that in the end, that it's really about where the child and the teacher meet and what the teacher can actually help them learn and move forward with.
But it's also about the parents. You can't, if you don't have a parent who takes them to tutorials or to get them involved, I mean, that's an important issue too. So you need to make sure the structure there is to help parents grow people out of poverty and other issues, or they're reaching into the family to assist them to get them to those great teachers and well-trained teachers.
And I'll just follow up with that. I have a friend of mine, and they're not in Atlanta. It's below Atlanta. But she had to move someone to another public, it's a public school. And this child was there for a while, and they called her and said, he's not showing up. And she goes, I know he is. I take him there. He's got to be there. And they said, just check again. And it's been a week. And they called back and said, you know what? He is here. The teacher didn't know who he was. He's been sitting there for a week, and they never knew who he was.
You know,
so stories like that just make you wonder if the teacher doesn't know who's in their class, how can they possibly teach them?
Yeah,
maybe they have too many.
That's a
even
good
with
point.
30, I wouldn't know who's in my class for a week. I just think that's anyway. So I guess my point is we forget in the end that the teacher, you know, they may need a smaller classroom, they may need extra support, they may need to do something, but they also have to understand. And I never think we give teachers enough credit. It's a hard job. It's an everyday job, and I think part of the challenge is we should be more appreciative
of
them.
No question teachers deserve more credit. But Lori, Jim, Steve, we certainly remember the last time a governor of Georgia decided to have a conversation about improving the quality of teachers in schools across the state. It was one of the things that cost him his re-election, Governor Roy Barker.
Governor.
I
will say this, though. My kids are in a brand new charter school here in Georgia. And when they were interviewing for teachers, they had a really great philosophy and a really great application process. They said it was so difficult because nowadays, and this is a really sad, I think, situation of where we are, is that if you're going into college and you want to make money and you want to do a good job, you're not going to be a teacher anymore. It's not respected like the way it used to be as when we were growing up. I mean, or maybe in the northern states where you make a ton of money and you can make a living at it. So many teachers here, you know, they have to work second jobs. And I think it's just a sad state of where we are in education.
Well, it wasn't that long ago. In the 1990s, Zell Miller started trying to address. We had 4 years in a row where we gave 4% raise to teachers. We got above the national average. And a lot of people were being drawn from the private sector to education and becoming teachers. What we've seen in the last 15 years is, you know, pay dropping, going way down nationally. I'd like to see the kind of emphasis the governor put a 20% raise for State Patrol and came back saying that was going to raise it up to about the national average. I'd like to see us start to try to address our teachers in the same kind of committed way to bring them up because, you know, it's been telling and a toll on teachers.
Before we leave state politics entirely and move on to some transition talk, Steve, Democrats had a disappointing election in 2014. Yet another rather disappointing cycle just this past year. Donald Trump won the state pretty handily after all of the predictions that maybe it was the finally time that Georgia was going to turn blue. It is never too early to look at 2018.
Sure.
Sure, here on Political Rewind, it's never too early. We've always got an election to talk about. Where do you stand in terms of organizing to come up with candidates, say, for an open gubernatorial seat, for state constitutional offices? It's been hard for you to find the kind of quality candidates you want for many seats in
for
the
an
state.
Open sixth district seat.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, in the legislative front, there were a few seats that are close, that are controlled by Republicans in both the House and Senate that give us some hope. You know, really the most interesting thing about the election was if you look at the 6th Senate district, you look at Framelars, the 40th, I believe. If you look at these districts, you saw Hillary Clinton winning big in Republican districts. David Schaefer's, I think Hillary won that district. I think we're going to see down the road whether Trump, you know, can alienate some traditionally Republican voters and whether or not that creates a new trend in Georgia or not. Now, he did win overall in Georgia and turned out a lot of rural votes. We're going to see whether that's a pattern that continues. So a lot of the changes that occurred between 1990 and 2002 were driven by a national element. And I think, again, in Georgia, we're going to see a driving force of the national element. So will there be a backlash? In 2008, Obama got a higher percentage of Georgia votes than we've gotten since in 47% or so. And then in 2010, around the country, we saw a backlash, and we lost hundreds of legislative seats around the country. So I think, you know, a lot of Democrats maybe on a pipe dream, you know, are hoping there'll be some kind of anti-Trump backlash. But that's, you know, that's something we're analyzing and looking at.
And you looking at candidates for governor right now?
Yeah, and I think...
Oh, you have to be.
Well, that's what I... Of course, yeah, but, you know...
And I think a lot of those candidates are looking, you know, what's going to be that effect? Is there going to be a backlash like there was in 2010?
Well, it doesn't matter whether there is or isn't. You have to have a good candidate, a good, solid candidate up there on 2018, because you've got the 2020 census coming right after that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And redistricting.
And you know, and we've had people, names have been out there before, from Stacey Abrams, Jason Carter, Kasim Reed, and others who are looking at the seat. Has anybody emerged and said they're definitely going? The answer is no.
Right.
Are we talking to folks? Sure.
Jackie, something is heartening to you as a Republican, that not only in Georgia, but a national trend. Democrats now control only 11 governors' mansions. I mean, only 11 Democratic governors in the United States. What has happened?
Maybe you should ask them. I don't know. I mean, I think I like to say that, I mean, what you've seen, especially with Trump now winning this election, is that I think we've come back to kind of where we were with Ronald Reagan, in that America works best when Americans are working. I mean, we want to be a country that is about working and making progress and working together and focus on the economy. And to do that, the Republican message often is much more attractive than what the Democrats say. And secondarily, I do think there, and it'd be interesting to see if it actually translates, but I do think there is a fallback that, you know, we went with Obama for 8 years and he promised us a lot of changes. But you know what? The government can't actually solve everything. And maybe we need a little less government and a little more private sector. And that's the kind of the phase that we're in now. So it'll be interesting to see how everything fleshes out. I have a lot of hope about where we are. I talked a lot about this in my column this week, but I've seen a lot of small business owners that have been very, very excited about Trump becoming president, you know, in January, because they're looking at fewer regulations, they're looking at lower, you know, corporate tax rates, and they're thinking about how they can grow and expand their businesses. And that's exactly what we need to generate momentum.
But Bill, to your point, I mean, I think Democrats have made a fairly big error in concentrating their faces, their power, their candidates on people who are even older than me. And that's saying,
oh,
that's,
man,
that's
that
saying,
is old.
I'm not Republican.
Glad you said that,
and,
Jim.
And look, they doubled down on it earlier this week or last week when they renominated Nancy Pelosi as the House Democratic leader.
Right. Right.
And I think you've got to have people start moving out of the way so you can get that new generations and new ideas and new faces out there.
And you got to remember that, you know, the election of Donald Trump is not just you know, a repudiation of what, you know, the big government and Obama, you know, and kind of that state. But it's also, you know, he won the Republican primary because the Republicans were tired of, you know, establishment Washington telling them what they should do. And so he's very much a populist Republican president, you know, will be a populist Republican president, I think. And I think it's interesting to watch kind of both systems kind of, you know, collapse to some degree. And it'll be interesting to see what happens.
All right, let's stick with this theme of old versus young for just a moment, because it allows us an opportunity to talk about a name we've brought up on this show a few times. But on the Republican side, we're getting reports today that the position of RNC chairman, which will be, it'll be the president-elect who will decide who the next chair of the RNC is coming down basically to two names. One of them is somebody all of us here have worked with to one extent or another, a 34-year-old political wunderkind, Nick Ayers. Mm-hmm. Interesting to think that there might be that kind of youth in the Republican leadership.
And, you know, I mean, you mentioned Nick Ayers as a wonder kid. I mean, at the age of 23, he was chairing Governor Sonny Perdue's campaign.
Oh, he was managing it. He wasn't the chairman.
He was managing it.
Yeah.
He was working very hard.
And it was the reelection campaign. It was the 2006.
Right. Yeah, he didn't
and
have
then,
enough money
the Republican
to be the
Governor's
chairman.
The Republican Governor's Association.
And he did a great job at RGA. I mean, he was a superstar at RGA. He raised a ton of money. He's very qualified for this job. But again, it's going to be Trump who determines who he wants in that position, as he should. I think Trump made a great choice picking Reince Priebus to actually be his chief of staff. I mean, Reince did a great job. And so I think he'll do a very good job as chief of staff, keeping the trains running and moving in the same direction.
But what's interesting is Nick is going up against Mitt Romney's niece.
Yes, exactly.
In Michigan, exactly. Here, and if Mitt doesn't get that Secretary of State's position, which I kind of doubt that he's going to, have to wonder whether that RNC position become for his niece becomes a consolation prize of some sort. But if Nick does get this, I mean, you have to look beyond Nick Ayers to see all the relations. This would be a huge step forward
for the Purdue's.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Sonny and David. Mm-hmm. And of course we all know and related to that is John Watson. Mm-hmm. Here in Georgia is a member of that kind of that circle and is running for state party chairman.
Yeah.
So you see all these currents and eddies moving toward something larger for David Perdue.
Steve, it does. You do wonder about young leaders in the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, we did have Debbie Wasserman Schultz. It wasn't that old, and we've had a lot of young and active people in the party.
How'd that work out?
I can't believe you brought her up.
Talk about her for a while. The best example that you want to
Well, you know, when you got Russian hacking going on, you know, you got problems, and that's going to be a lot of problems. But we've got a lot of active young people in the party, both state level and nationally. You know, I don't think that's an issue. If you look at millennials, if they had been voting, we would have, you look at Rudy Giuliani, you look at a lot of people who are advisors.
Well,
there
that's
with
true.
The
that's
president,
right.
And, you know, you're talking old. You look at our governor, who's well over 70. You know, you look at the Republican Party. I'm still kind of holding back from Jackie talking about job creations when we had a president who created more jobs under his administration than anybody else and harping over that than to get onto this thing about youth. Democrats certainly are the party that is appealing to young people because we care about protecting the environment. We show a commitment to the personal liberties and freedom of women, allow them to make personal health decisions, especially with concern abortion and other issues. And I think that we certainly do. And I agree with Jim. We do need to make sure more young people are getting out there. And I think that you'll probably be her last term as far as Speaker Pelosi. But, you know, Democrats were kind of in shock after this election. A lot of people didn't want to make a change.
All right. So we are going to talk, speaking of the environment, you gave us a setup in a couple minutes. We're going to talk about Donald Trump's choice for head of EPA, as well as his labor secretary nominee and a lot of other things. But you know what? One of the things I pride myself on here at Political Rewind, Jim, is we always are able to dig out what is truly the big political story, regardless of what the rest of the media is talking about. And this is it.
I'm back. Welcome to the new season of Celebrity Apprentice. I'm the new boss.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, but the boss has got a new boss.
And that's the point. Before we take a break, Lori Geary, Donald Trump has announced, he's made it clear that despite the fact he's going to be the leader of the free world, he's also going to continue in his role as executive producer of Celebrity Apprentice.
I just can't. If you are the most powerful man in the world, why do you need to be executive producer of a television show? It just doesn't jive.
Like, I think it's like Obama liked to play basketball.
Comparison to Obama playing golf.
I think he likes
golf.
To produce TV shows. And I mean, Trump we all have hobbies, right?
I don't think Obama was on the pro circuit. No, he wasn't getting money.
This is the Kellyanne Conway argument, of course, Jackie.
Oh, absolutely. Trust me. I mean, my father is very much the same way. I mean, they constantly have to be doing something. They're interested
Wait,
in everything.
Your father never relaxes.
He's going to be a little busy. Trump is going to be a
but
little
everyone,
busy.
Everyone needs a diversion every once in a while. And this is the idea of a diversion. You know, think of it as a hobby.
Well, that's a good point, is whether or not this is something that just affects that TV show or hobby. But what he's shown is kind of in general, a lot of people are concerned that this extends to his other business interests, which go to a lot of different countries, a lot of different companies, and a lot of construction in other places, a lot of businesses in other places, and how that affects our international relations down the road is much bigger than who does the your fire program.
This is a paycheck, and I think it reflects just as much on NBC as it does on the White House. That raises all sorts of journalistic hackles in my
world. Absolutely.
All right. We'll move on. There are some truly big news on the Trump transition that we can talk about in a minute. But let's get our second break of the show out of the way because it's already 3:45. We'll come back in just a minute with more.
My favorite show is Morning Edition.
I really enjoy a lot of the programming, especially on Second Thought.
I really like Fresh Air.
I love Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Turn your car into your favorite shows and donate it to GPB. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate online at gpb.org/cars. Do it today and you'll be set for a 2016 tax deduction. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We're back. I'm Bill Nigut. Jim Galloway is here, as he always is. Thank goodness. Steve Henson, State Senate Democratic leader. Lori Geary, who has stepped down from her role as political reporter for WSB-TV in Atlanta. Boy, I know how that feels. It's liberating, isn't it?
It is. It's still a little weird, but it's liberating. Right.
And Jackie Gingrich Cushman is back with us. What was your column this week, Jackie?
So my column this week, we talked about what a difference a month makes from where we were a month ago before the election, right, when we didn't know what was going to happen, to where we are now. We have the stock market up. We have it's just fascinating to watch. We, like I said, a lot of enthusiasm from small business owners. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens.
Okay. Want to just make a quick housekeeping note here. Starting on Monday, January 9th, Political Rewind expands to 3 days a week. We'll be on the air Mondays and Wednesdays at 2 o'clock, and we'll keep in our 3 p.m. slot on Friday. Some people have asked why we're not on all three consistent on all 3 days. That's just a programming issue. We've got lots of little blocks to put in place. So Tuesday, Monday and Wednesday at 2.
We've got no hobgoblins in our head. We're not consistent at all.
That's right. All right, Steve, you talked about the environment. We had an interesting choice this week for EPA chief Jim Galloway. For EPA chief, we had Scott Pruitt, who is the attorney general in the state of Oklahoma. He has sued EPA. He has made it relatively clear in his career that he would like to completely dismantle EPA. He certainly doesn't favor government regulations that have anything to do with easing pollution. What is this about?
This is about paying back your friends. And you know, look, this is Donald Trump represented more than Donald Trump. He represented a Republican Party that wanted to severely curtail the federal government. And this is the beginning of that process. I mean, Pruitt was he's not only a climate change denier. He's a very, very close friend to the oil industry, mm-hmm. to fracking, and he has been the coordinator of a lot of these federal lawsuits that have been aimed at the EPA.
I think this all comes down to the regulations that we've heard so much about. I mean, when we had Senator David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson release news releases about, you know, the EPA wanting to regulate puddles and where the water is standing, and Republicans just getting, you know, outraged about those types of things. So when they bring somebody like a Scott Pruitt on, who has sued the EPA time and time again, it's very popular among that base.
I mean, this is a lot like James Watts in the Reagan
yeah.
administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Energy, right.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to see battles move to the state level a lot. The few states that have Democratic control are going to be passing laws, I think, to make sure that if fracking is done, it's done, that properly evaluated for safety. I think other states, we're going to be pushing back on that, even in minority, trying to get public opinion as different environmental rules come under assault and whether or not the states should step up.
But Jackie, Pruitt is an example, in a way, of what you're talking about. You've said a couple times on the show, businesses are excited about Trump.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this is, as Laurie said, this is part of loosening up the regulations and making sure the businesses can get to work. And I think sometimes in an effort to explain things, we are a little too simplistic that, you know, if you're against regulation, then you're against the environment. And I think that's absolutely not true. I think we have to do a lot of kind of parsing the middle. And, you know, for myself, for instance, I've been involved with the Trust for Public Land for 15 years. My dad helped get the money that saved the Chattahoochee You know, so we've been very involved with the environment, but that doesn't mean that we think we should regulate all the puddles. So
but
I think
you're
we have
not
to,
a
you know,
climate change denier.
But I think we have to understand that you can't. Nothing's always black and white. You have to figure out what actually works. Yeah, you need to be able to do both.
Right. I think we can all agree is that this actually means something very important for the nuclear industry. Mm-hmm. In the United States, and for any efforts by the Southern Company or Georgia Power in the South to expand on that.
Well, but the reality is that presumably a guy like Pruitt would have an impact on Steve Coal, big coal, mm-hmm. being able to expand its mm-hmm. operations, which Trump would say is great for the economy because it'll put people back to work. That's really not going to happen because the energy companies have moved beyond all of that.
Right. No, coal isn't subject to market forces. Coal is subject to market forces,
right.
And they don't favor it anymore.
Right. Yeah. That's my point.
Well, and you know, talking about the nuclear industry, of course, Obama was, you know, pro-nuclear power and was helping move forward with our plants here in Georgia and other places. So we'll see. But I don't disagree with Jackie that, you know, doing away with some regulations isn't a good thing. We as Democrats have done that. But what we've seen here are some people who are very extreme. We're not talking about middle-of-the-road folks. So we'll have to see whether the rhetoric that they've said in the past is something they live up to or whether or not they take a more practical approach now that they're in a managerial position.
So another pick this week that caught a lot of people off guard was Donald Trump's choice of Andrew Pudzer, P-U-D-Z-E-R, as labor secretary. He runs a company that includes operation of Hardee's and Carl Jr.'s fast food restaurants. He has been a real critic of raising the minimum wage. He has been quoted as saying that he wishes he could install robots into some of his restaurants for variety. They always upsell. They never complain about working conditions. They don't sue for gender discrimination or age discrimination. He has taken great pride in the commercials, Jim, for Carl Jr. He likes, as he has said, there's nothing I like more than seeing a beautiful woman in a bikini eating a hamburger. What those commercials show us.
I mean, it's not too far away from the old days of Playboy. You kind of wince every time you see them. But he is now going to be in charge of making sure that women get a fair shake in the workplace.
I think it's actually a fascinating appointment. I'm actually encouraged by it for a couple of reasons. First of all, so my second job, my first paying job was, which I'm sure you've heard before, is cleaning bathrooms in my church. My second paying job when I was growing up was working at Sonic. And so I was actually a roller skating waitress. I know, that's shocking. Change belt and everything. But I think to have someone that's actually worked in that environment, understands the challenges, I think is really fascinating. And the reality is, you know, when I started that job, I never thought I was going to be there forever. I thought I was going to be there for a summer or a couple of years, and then I'd go on and do something else. So I do think that we have to realize that there are some jobs that are structured and need to be at a lower rate because that's where your entry level is. That's where you work doing the you know, that's what happens. And I think secondarily, your comment earlier, Jim, about the burgers and bikinis, I mean, he'll say it very, very, our sales went up. I mean, see, do you blame him or do you blame the people that then went to his restaurants and bought the burgers? So,
well, for a presidential elect who has faced a lot of accusations.
And look, we now have a president who has appeared in softcore porn videos. So this isn't too far out. But I would point out that Trump's nominee is actually getting some pushback from the people at Breitbart. Who are pointing to the fact that this fellow tends to hire, they allege that they
hire foreign labor.
Foreign labor, and with the kind of implication that it's illegal labor.
Jim and I talked about this before the show. Of all the Trump nominees and appointment, I think this is the one that really might be the most troublesome. And I'm not ready to bet on it, but I wonder if he's actually going to be confirmed when you stack up a lot of concerns about him.
And I know I was speaking with someone on the transition team and getting a little bit of background. They really wanted somebody who had workforce development in their backgrounds and training and how to train workers. And I'm not sure if Andrew Pudster is the best one to fit this bill. And there's going to be a lot of controversy around him. So I think you're right, Bill. I think it's going to be a tough confirmation.
You know, it's interesting because Trump's emphasis has been returning manufacturing jobs to the United States. And this fellow is not that. This is your ultimate service economy worker. Low wages. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. We will watch that unfold and see how it does.
But he did give a lot of money to the Trump
campaign.
He
gave a great deal of money.
So,
yeah.
Swamp being drained.
All right. I really want to stop talking about politics long enough to talk about one of the great Americans.
T minus 10 seconds. Counting. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff. The MA-6 vehicle has lifted off. Trajectory looks good. All three big engines burning clean and hot.
That was February 20th, 1962. John Glenn sitting atop that powerful rocket in Friendship 7 to begin three orbits around the Earth.
And I can guarantee you, I was in a classroom where they had the TV going on that one.
Yeah, I was a sophomore in high school, and we all sat.
I can guarantee you, I was not.
I was alive. I was three.
One of the things I thought about, because this is Political Rewind, of course, Glenn had a remarkable career, a heroic career in space. But then, Jim, you know, he came back and he became a member of the United States Senate. And I thought, one of the nicest things we could do is play a portion of a speech he gave that I think most people agreed was the most important speech he ever did. He was running in Ohio against Howard Metzenbaum for the Democratic nomination for the Senate in 1974. He'd lost to Metzenbaum in 70, and now he was back. And in a debate at the Cleveland City Club, Metzenbaum said, "You're a guy who's never even held a job." And in response to that, John Glenn made remarks that are remembered to this day as some of the best that a politician has ever uttered.
I was in the space program. It wasn't my checkbook, it was my life that was on the line. As I went the other day out to a veterans hospital, look those men out there with their mangled bodies in the eye and tell them they didn't hold a job. You go with me to any Gold Star mother and you look her in the eye and you tell her that her son did not hold a job. You stand in Arlington National Cemetery, where I have more friends than I like to remember, and you think about this nation and you tell me that those people didn't have a job. I tell you, Howard Metzenbaum, you should be on your knees every day of your life thanking God that there were some men, who held a job. And they required a dedication to purpose and a love of country and a dedication to duty that was more important than life itself.
John Glenn.
And so he held it for 24 years.
Yeah. He had a long career and was considered, you know, a moderate in the United States Senate and a conciliatory force, a collaborator.
So, a fellow so affable that he could not win a Democratic primary for president.
Yeah, that's right. He had a very bad time trying to run for president and didn't get anywhere. Look, we are out of time for this show. Jackie Gingrich Cushman, Senator Steve Henson, Lori Geary, and Jim Galloway, so glad you could join us today for Political Rewind. We will be back next Wednesday at 2 o'clock with another show, and then Friday at 3. Next Friday at 3, we're going to talk again about media and the complications of covering the Donald Trump presidential transition and some of the concerns as we move forward to the Trump presidency. That's next Friday. So stay with us. I'm Bill Nygut. Our senior producer, Jenny Amet, is all alone in the control room today. She's been abandoned by everyone. She's still the best. Thank you for everything you do, Jenny. We'll see you again next Wednesday at 2.
Thank you.